the House Committee on Environment and Land Use. It is 8:38, and we have one member who is excused because of illness, Representative Rosenbaum. We shall start with our agenda, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2610. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2610 places the burden on local government on appeal of a local land use decision to demonstrate that its decision is in compliance with applicable legal requirements. It specifies the burden of proof is applicable to petitions filed after the effective date of the act. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under Oregon's removal fill law, which is Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 196-800 to 196-990, removal, filling, or alteration of 50 or more cubic yards of material within the beds and banks of waters of the state requires a permit from the Division of State Lands. ORS 197.829 requires the Land Use Board of Appeals, commonly known as LUBA, to affirm a local government's interpretation of its comp plan and land use regulation with exceptions. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Administrator, and we will start with our list with Linda Ludwig and Pam Beery. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities. I brought with me today Pam Beery from Beery and Elsler. Pam's kind of our legal beagle, and I brought her along. We wanted to talk to you about HB 2610. And also for the record, Mr. Chair, I believe a portion of what was read as the bill description was not relevant to HB 2610. So you might double check that. The portion about removal fill, I believe, should be absent from
Mr.
the summary.
Mm-hmm.
It's one to nothing already.
And it's a Thursday morning.
It's not good to trump the chair, however.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was not trumping the chair. I was just doing one of those administrative calls.
And I'm just joking. Okay, Linda, good morning.
I would love to come before the committee with support for a bill, but unfortunately, again, I'm coming to you with comments in opposition to House Bill 2610. HB 2610 primarily requires local governments to bear the burden of demonstrating that its position is correct at LUBA. It reverses the universal standard that the petitioner or the appellant has the burden of establishing that the lower court, the lower body, the lower court, local government acting quasi-judicially, erred. It reverses not only established LUBA practice, but is also contrary to the standard adopted in any appeal in our judicial system. Theoretically, local government findings associated with the land use decisions would adequately address compliance with applicable goals, statutes, rules, and code criteria. A city is currently required to demonstrate compliance with the adoption of a decision that is supported by adequate findings and substantial evidence in the record. The petitioner must, by definition, assign error and show how that decision is inconsistent with applicable evidence that was brought forward in the local land use hearing. That is the essence of our appeal process. HB 2610 significantly broadens the scope of a LUBA appeal beyond consistency with local government plan and land use regulations to consistency with all state statutes and goals. Effectively, we would be forced to do a mini periodic review goal analysis to demonstrate the consistency of every land use decision rather than rely on the assumption that the acknowledged local plan makes the decision consistent with state goals and regulations. This is radically different procedurally than the current system where LUBA reviews cases on the record, where no new information is allowed if not developed in a prior proceeding, and MLUBA's decision is based only on information submitted into the record at that local government level. No party can introduce new evidence into the record at LUBA, and the focus is on the record that was established at the local government level where the decision was made. That's very, very important. I want to underline that. This gives local governments a chance to rectify the issue before a costly LUBA appeal is filed. The bill opens up the LUBA proceeding to allow new information into the record and would require responses to issues that are raised by appellants, even if the appellant does not develop those arguments related to that issue in the local hearing. HB 2610 provides for an unpredictable, inefficient process. The advocates for this bill may not realize in some cases that the switch in the burden will work against developers in favor of opponents of development projects when the local government has approved a project, but in other cases will work in favor of developers and against opponents when local governments have denied the application. This bill could require developers to pay more, and let me run you through a couple of examples. Suppose an applicant for a subdivision is granted an approval by a city, but a neighbor doesn't like the decision and appeals the decision to LUBA. The neighbor appellant says the decision generally violates a host of goals and several statutes. Suppose that not all these issues were raised at the local government hearing level or considered by the developer applicant or the local government at that local government hearing. Under this bill, with the burden of proof transferred to the city, if the city couldn't undertake the additional cost burden, they could simply not show up, resulting in the applicant or the developer having to intervene in the proceeding and would bear that extended burden of proof, including those extended costs, which went far beyond what was presented in the record at the local government hearing. It could work the other way as well. Local decisions to deny are often based on lack of evidence, which could mean that under the bill, developers could essentially make out like a bandit and be subsidized by taxpayers. Here's another example. Suppose a developer proposes a subdivision in a steep slope area, does not submit enough evidence that the soils are stable, so the city denies the application. The developer appeals to LUBA, and with the burden of proof transferred to the city, in order to defend the denial, the city would have to spend additional taxpayer money to do the soil stability study that the developer did not do to prove the soil wasn't stable. Otherwise, the decision could be remanded by LUBA. Another point in this bill is the inconsistency within the statute, within sub 1 and 3 in 197.829, and what we call a presumption of guilt. The bill essentially presumes a presumption of guilt for actions of local government elected officials, which is absolutely contrary to the basis of our entire system of laws. The shifting of the burden of proof presumes that local government erred, and local government officials are guilty of violating state law unless they can prove their innocence. This is absolutely contrary to what our legal system is all about. Additionally, within the language of sub 1 and 3, it creates an inconsistency within the statute because sub 1 contains the assumption that the local action is in compliance, while the new language in sub 3 states that we are obligated to prove that we are. Finally, and maybe most importantly, HB 2610 is an unfunded mandate to local governments. Under the broad language of the bill, there is no way of knowing how the petitioner applicant believes that the local government erred, and it would result in cost increases as local jurisdictions have to pay staff, consultants, attorneys to verify this extended scope that every conceivable legal requirement has been met, not just the ones that have been established in the lower body. We believe our costs, local government costs, would be increased substantially, and it's been estimated that those costs would at least double, if not be significantly more than that. Conservatively, that transfers into increases of $2.5 to $5 million per year for local governments, and by local governments, I mean both cities and counties. These costs would likely be passed into the private applicant in increased application fees or subsidized by our taxpayers. Inevitably, local governments would prepare staff reports on every discretionary permit issuance with this shadow boxing, this broad scope shadow boxing standard in mind. We believe that the cost for the simplest permits would go up if this bill is passed. Some last thoughts. I would like to throw out that 2610 would likely have an adverse impact on economic development. The private sector seeks predictability and reliance in our land use process. By changing this standard under the bill, I believe the legislature is sending a negative message concerning its support of local land use approvals and the reliance that an applicant can place on that. By changing the burden at LUBA, it would likely make a city's decision more vulnerable by not having the presumption of validity and by having to prove its consistency. By eroding the presumption, it makes investment in economic development projects, particularly large-scale projects, more questionable and may discourage investment in the state. And given the present delicate state of our economy and the need to support increased business development and job opportunities in the state, it would seem unwise if you support 2610 at this time.
Thank you, Linda. Any questions for Ms. Ludman?
I do.
Representative Richards.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ludman, as you presented your position, you've used terms like guilt and innocence as if this was a criminal issue, but is not this really a case where the government has the power and the government is appealing to another government agency, and at risk are the individual rights of property owners? Do you agree, first of all, that we're not talking about guilt and innocence between equal parties, we're talking about government power, government agency, and individual property rights?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, I do agree with that.
Okay, would it make a difference?
May I follow? Excuse me.
Follow.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lovery, you've also focused on developers. Would it make a difference if the wording was not focused on large developments with developers, but was amended so that it protected individual property owners?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I used only the examples for developers here. It's not my belief that the rights of individual property owners are particularly at stake under this bill.
Do you feel that appeals to a state agency are on the same level as an appeal to an independent judiciary? Well, that may be. Doesn't matter to me which answers it.
If you want to hear my testimony first, I can respond after. I'd be happy if you want to repeat it for me. I'd be happy to answer it now.
Okay.
For the record, this is Pam Beery. I'm about to testify on the same bill.
If I may repeat it, my point, what I'm getting at really, is that in the approach so far that what we've heard, it's showing that there, or it's implying that there is an equal position between the cities or the government and those that are involved with the property, and with LUBA and appellate courts in our judiciary. And I guess what I'm doing is just trying to bring out whether or not you really believe that those positions are equal in both of those levels.
Mr. Chair and Representative, actually what my testimony will be directed to, and I can answer your question in advance of that, is that in fact in the land use context, the local government is sitting as a decision maker. Really, it is not a case of government power, if you will. It is the case where the government is acting as in a quasi-judicial or even in a legislative capacity. It's the government's job in that context to be the to weigh the evidence presented by all parties and all participants. There are significant protections in the process for all the players, from the applicant to the representatives of citizens or citizens who oppose development. And so really the government is neutral rather than being an advocate of one proponent or the other. So it really isn't a case of needing to be equal, and certainly one might argue that government is better prepared or financially better equipped, but I'm here to tell you that's not always the case, because there are 240 cities in Oregon, many of whom have very, very scarce resources and who pay dearly for services from people like me to try to help them through this very complex process.
Representative Greenlee?
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Love. I'd like to understand a little better what you're saying in this context. And what I hear you saying is that things go to LUBA because somebody applies for something to the city, applies for some exemption or some land use or something. And the city says yes. And then that may be appealed because somebody else says, well, the city should have said no. Or sometimes it comes because an applicant comes to the city and says, I want to do this, and the city says, no, you can't. And that person appeals. So this isn't an issue about one side or the other, as I understand it. Is that right? It's an issue of either somebody saying, you shouldn't have let the developer build that, or you shouldn't have let that property owner do that dumb thing they want to do. They want to build something and they shouldn't. And city says no, and they appeal, or they say yes, and somebody else appeals. So in either case, the city's likely, under this statute, is likely going to have to say, okay, now we have to gather up everything. We made a decision. We have to go prove now we've made the right decision, and it might be the right decision is yes, or it might be the right decision is no.
Okay.
Is that
right?
Interesting.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, that is absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, sir.
Ms. Berry, if you'd like to go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Axel.
Thank you.
That was a good stretch, Bob.
So maybe I'll reserve my question until Mr. Piotation.
We also, I've been informed, have Chris Crane here from LC that might be able to answer some of the prospective questions, too. But go ahead and proceed, Ms. Berry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here this morning. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Pam Berry. I am a lawyer in private practice in Portland. Our firm is somewhat unique in that it is devoted exclusively to the representation of government. It's the only firm in the state that does that, as far as I'm aware. I haven't yet had the pleasure of driving to Salem for this session, but this bill got my blood pressure up enough that I felt compelled to do that this morning, despite the fact that I was at a city council meeting late last night. So
stick around, we have a lot more.
I can see that. You had a lot of excitement going on this morning. I should also tell you that my face will likely get very red. That's because this issue does excite me, and I have high blood pressure, but I am not in danger of keeling over, so just ignore it.
We can have the administrator have security here.
That's probably a good idea. Just panic button at the ready. Thank you. Just a little background on me, since you don't know me, not to toot my own horn, but I have been a lawyer in private practice representing government for 22 years. I'm the past chair of the real estate and land use section of the bar, past president of the Oregon City Attorneys Association, and I currently serve as the statewide coordinator for the City Attorneys Association. I regularly defend cases for governments at LUBA and onto the Court of Appeals. It's a primary part of my practice, and so Linda asked me to help her answer some of your questions and also present kind of a real-world perspective from somebody who's in the trenches doing these cases on a daily basis. I have two major points, both of which are contained in my written testimony, but I want to highlight for you, and then I'm happy to answer questions. The first one follows up on something that Linda said. She's absolutely correct, though she's not a lawyer and I don't think plays one on television. She is absolutely right that the entire judicial system, not just the land use system, but the entire judicial system is based on the foundation that a party bringing an action has the burden of proving their case. The Oregon Supreme Court, in fact, in the case I've cited to you in my materials, in a landmark case 30 years ago now, Fasano versus Washington County, determined that that same rule applies in land use proceedings in our state. In other words, the applicant who wants something changed bears the burden of proof. So we've had that law for 30 years. The only exception that I note that's been carved out was done by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Dolan case that you're probably all familiar with. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said the government does bear the burden in one situation, and that is where we impose conditions of approval on an applicant that require them to dedicate a property interest, the so-called takings laws. So we bear the burden in that one case based on U.S. Supreme Court precedent, but nowhere else in our system is that true. And this bill would propose that radical a change. It's a very sweeping change, should not be undertaken lightly. It is inconsistent with and undermines numerous provisions of ORS Chapter 197 that have to do with burden of proof, how hearings are conducted, the scope of LUBA's review. As Linda pointed out, LUBA's review is on the record. This would change that. There's a great deal of internal inconsistency in the statute that would be created by this one very narrow and, I think, very ill-advised change. It would also undermine all of the statutes having to do with the Department of Land Conservation and Development's role in acknowledging local comprehensive plans. I don't see them here supporting this bill. I don't believe that this bill has been coordinated with them. And believe me, there is work underway all over the state right now. There are hearings scheduled later this month here in Salem on periodic review work that's been going on for years. And this bill would absolutely devastate the work that's been undertaken by cities and counties in reliance on a well-understood system that we've had in place for a long time. That's the legal problem. The other problem is cost. As Linda pointed out, I would totally support her estimate of a minimum of $2.5 million a year in cost to local government. The way we got that number is we took the cost of defending an average appeal today for a local government, just a run-of-the-mill, not very complicated case, and looked at the number of decisions that LUBA hands down in any given year. Last year it was 172. And when the government changes from defending its decision, regardless of it being an approval or denial, to bearing the burden for the entire case, that at least doubles the cost because, as Linda pointed out, we're having to address every standard from both perspectives and rehash the entire decision rather than simply supporting the decision we've already made, which we already do. So the $2.5 million annual cost is a very conservative estimate. It's not necessarily widely known, but smaller cities and counties have to pay by the hour for legal services, just like any other client does, just like the applicant and the opponents do. They don't have stables of lawyers standing at the ready to run and defend these cases, so it is a very real dollar cost. It's out-of-pocket money cities can't afford. And those are my major points, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Any questions, Ms. Berry?
Yes, Ms. Berry, I thought we might ask some questions which would be designed to inform the committee a little bit about how the fact-finding process mm-hmm. works at the local level mm-hmm. because, or at the hearings level, because mm-hmm. the bill does apply this standard to not only appeals, but to, it says proceedings before the board and the appeal therefrom. I don't know if they intend that would be... local fact-finding agency? Would that be your interpretation?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we read the bill to apply only, and I certainly pray that's the case, only before LUBA and not at the local level.
Okay.
Board should probably have been capitalized to make that clear in that sentence, but in any case, the current standard is, as Linda pointed out, that the record is created at the local level. We're the fact finder. And the board simply reviews that record and is very, very judicious about not accepting new evidence. So that's how we interpret it.
I guess I'm in doubt, and maybe you can help me, when the bill says, in any proceeding before the board and mm-hmm. any appeal therefrom, do you still feel the board is LUBA itself, or is it the local fact-finding board?
Mr. Chair, I felt that the words "and any appeal therefrom" referred to the matter going on from the board, the LUBA, Land Use Board of Appeals, to the Court of Appeals, which is where proceedings go.
Okay. Now, in appeals to LUBA, there's no new testimony taken, is that correct?
That is correct.
And the record would consist of not only the decision of the fact finder, but a definite statement of facts to support the decision. Is that correct?
That is correct. In every case, the local government is required to make findings of conformance with all applicable criteria.
And that basically forces a hearing officer to take a very rigorous review of all the evidence, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Now, if that record is insufficient, that is, there are not sufficient findings to support the hearing officer's decision, Luba then would virtually have no choice but to remand for further proceedings. Is that correct?
That is correct, and they very regularly do that.
And is it your opinion that this deliberate fact-finding process works in the best interest of all parties to create a accurate factual record for decision make per decision?
It is.
Okay.
I'm allowing you to continue.
I was going to ask that he gets special exemption.
Okay. Okay, I have one more question. Then. Does it appear that to you that the bill does create somewhat of a presumption against the decision-making process, that the initial decision by the local government entity?
Yes, I do. I do agree with Ms. Ludwig's testimony on that point, because it does clearly state the local government has the burden of demonstrating the consistency of its decision with all standards, and that's a radical change. I do believe that's the case.
Thank you.
The chair would appreciate members requesting a follow-up on multiple questions exceeding 20.
He's used to court
representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding this $2.5 to $5 million, who pays that now, or would that be an overall increase? I mean,
it is an overall increase. The current cost of funding these appeals is paid by local government from whatever source they can derive it, typically their general fund, typically subsidized by taxpayers. Linda's correct on that point. It is very common practice for local government who cannot afford to fully participate to allow an applicant, if the applicant wins below, to bear the full cost. So I think she's also correct that applicants who are successful will end up paying a lot more money defending appeals.
Representative Greenland.
Yeah, I want to ask you again a question on this and any appeal thereof. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me, reading that, even in a narrow sense, this now applies a new standard for the appeals court.
Oh, yes.
And would apply not only to things that happen in Luba, but would define the way an appeals court would have to hear that. Is that correct?
I absolutely agree with you. I do think that's what those words mean. We're trying to redefine the Court of Appeals role, too.
May I ask a follow-up? Do you know of any other examples where this kind of a statute gives the appeals court the instructions on how to define for the plaintiff or for the defendant?
No.
This seems very unusual.
And it's very unusual. I was thinking of some very obscure writs of review and so forth, where there are highly regimented standards of review prescribed by the court, but that's the only kind of direction that the legislature ever customarily gives, is a guidance on the scope of review rather than who bears the burden of proof. Very unusual.
Committee, we are presently trying to reach and have addressed the committee the drafter of this bill for interpretation to make sure that we're on the right track with where we're going.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one more question regarding my $2.5 million to $5 million? Does that mean like Duford, McDonald, each city would pay that amount of money, or is that the cities in the state, or what?
That's a cumulative estimated total. Again, we took the average cost of defending one case. We looked at Luba's record in terms of how many cases statewide they actually issue each year and just did the math. So it's a statewide total. A really straightforward, simple Luba case, you'd be probably shocked to know these days, even at my very reasonable hourly rate, costs about $12,000 to $15,000 to defend.
This would be a good bill for you, then.
Well, you know, I thought about that on the way down, Mr. Chair.
There's a conflict of interest here.
I just can't in good conscience support it, regardless. Thank you for pointing that out.
Land Use Lawyer for Employment Act.
Are there any other questions for either Ms. Ludwig or Ms. Berry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
We are waiting for Harrison Connolly, who is the drafter of this bill, in that we've had several people question the wording in the bill. But as we're waiting for Mr. Connolly, we'll go. Art, you're up. Not as a substitute by any means.
No, it's not.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And surprisingly enough, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here in opposition to House Bill 2610. I know you, Representative Greenlake, you're surprised by that. But let me point out a couple of things. And I don't want to repeat the testimony of the previous two witnesses because I concur wholeheartedly in the comments that they made to you regarding the fiscal impact and some of the other impacts to local government. Certainly, this bill would represent an unfunded mandate in its present form at this point to local government. It requires places of burdens on local government, which we do not have at this time. And in that, I think there's also a unintended consequence in all probability encouraging additional appeals to be filed because the burden is no longer on the appellant. The burden is on the local government. And so the appellant will not have to bear the responsibility of going forward either at LUBA or at the Court of Appeals to defend or to make their position known and also to participate at that point. Also, another provision, since you've got legislative counsel maybe coming, let me just point out to you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission, ORS 197-350. ORS 197-350 says the burden of persuasion or proof in an appeal to the board, and that's the board here in statute means LUBA, or the commission, this is LCDC, and sub A says a party appealing a land use decision or limited land use decision made by a local government to the board or the land conservation and development has the burden of persuasion. ORS 197-350 clearly places the burden on the appellant. There's a conflict potentially between 350 and what has been drafted, at least in as I review the statutes. These two provisions would conflict at this point. Many times in land use, and I was a county planning director for a number of years, there are what I call 5149ers. 5149ers are, you look at all the evidence, you hear all the testimony, and boy, oh boy, I probably could come down on either side. Even as a planning director, I have to look at the evidence and make a recommendation, and wow, it's close. Given that, you know, this bill sets up a situation where, depending on how you come down on those sometimes very close calls, you're going to have to look at defending maybe even the other side. You may deny it, and now you're put in a position of going to LUBA based on an appeal and then trying to say why it should have been maybe approved or based on the goals. And these put local decision makers in a very, very tough situation. The other thing that happens sometimes with these close calls is the local government, when it makes its decision, recognizing the limitations on its finances and the fact of requiring, you know, having county council involved in their planning department involved in any kind of appeals will tell the applicant straight away that if this is approved, it will be your burden to defend any appeal in at LUBA or any place in the future from there. So with those comments, Mr. Chair, I would urge the committee to reject House Bill 2610.
Thank you, Mr. Slough. We have Mr. Conley here, and Art, you'll be sticking around in case the committee has some questions, but since we took him away from his very busy schedule at the moment. Good morning, Harrison.
Good morning, Chair Garrard, members.
We had questions as to the definition of board, and Representative Ackerman and Representative Richardson, I think, both had questions in that regard as to the intent of the bill. So could you inform the committee along those lines, please?
Mr. Chair, members, in terms of our form and style manual, I think it's very clear here that board is a reference back to LUBA. Frequently, what we do, what the form and style manual calls for, is the first time we mention an entity like the Land Use Board of Appeals, we would use the full reference in a section, and then subsequent references could be shortened as long as it doesn't cause any conflict, as long as you're not talking about, for example, two different departments within the same section. In that case, you would specify it at each use. But here, clearly, board is intended to reference back to LUBA. I believe I heard Ms. Beery's testimony, yes. I believe it was, and I think as well, appeal is an appeal to the Court of Appeals from a LUBA decision.
Any other questions for Mr. Conley?
Thank you, sir.
I'm sorry, Representative Greenway.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, sir.
Does it seem to you that Section 3 is in direct conflict with Section 1? I mean, it does seem to me. It seems to me Section 1 sets some rules and then Section 3 sets some other rules.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I'm not quite sure. I guess I'd like to take a second look at that a little closer. Certainly I heard some issues with ORS 197.350 that was mentioned by Art here, and frankly, as I was listening to you talk, I thought of another statute that I'd like to take a look at as well, so it may be that there's some inconsistency here and we need to make a few additional changes to make this policy work.
May I follow? I mean, it seems to me Section 1 says LUBA should affirm a government decision unless these things are done. And then 3, it says that a government has to prove its decision was consistent with everything else. It does seem just a little odd to me. You may want.
I think perhaps you're right.
Any other questions? Harrison, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, Chair Barone.
Were there any questions for Art Schlepp from the counties? Okay, Don Schellenberg, Farm Bureau.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Here today supporting the principle that I think is at the core of this thing, and I think Representative Greenlee hit the issue right on the head. And that's the issue we've had in the farm zones in particular when people usually apply for a conditional use and to do something or another, some type of non-farm use in the farm zone. And that applicant may either be denied or approved, and someone disagrees with the county's decision on that. What usually happens is they go to the county desk to make their application, and nice people that they are, they're at the county desk. They may not question them very deeply about what they're wanting to do. The applicant may not have sought legal help in determining whether or not they could do what they want to do. And so they give them the application, They proceed with it. The public hearing is held. The local decision-making body makes a decision one way or the other. And in the case of the applicant, if this decision is a favorable decision, then they and favorable decision, and then it's appealed. The applicant is surprised when they find out they have to stand the full cost of defending that decision at LUBA. And I'm wondering, you know, where was the county? Why didn't they tell me that I couldn't do this thing, or whatever the case may be? So it's something that happens. I don't know if you can call it a regular basis, but we've had numerous complaints at Farm Bureau by people who found themselves defending a decision at LUBA based on the decision the county made, and wondering why the county wasn't there helping them. And so I don't know whether this is the right bill to address that issue or not, but when I read the bill, that seemed to be the premise of it. One of the advantages of the concept, you know, this again may not be the right wording, but if you had the right wording, one of the advantages of the concept would cause the decision maker to make a very judicious decision, knowing that they may have to spend some money to defend that decision, and in addition, it wouldn't waste the time or money of the applicant who wanted to do whatever it was they wanted to do and thought they could, and didn't find out they couldn't until they got the LUBA. So that's the extent of my comment, Mr. Chairman. I do have testimony where I'll hand in to you.
Any questions of Mr. Schellenberg? Seeing none, thank you, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Doug Riggs?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Riggs. I'm here today representing the Central Oregon Cities organization. We include Bend, Redmond, Madras, Sisters, Metolius, and Culver, and we are following these bills very carefully. I won't go into a great deal of detail. I think that the previous speakers have illustrated some of the concerns that we have. I'll only go into three brief concerns that we have with the bill as written. First is the premise of the bill. The bill seems to be governed by the premise that local governments are anti-development. And that may be the case in some parts of the state. But I will tell you that our local elected officials, many of whom are businessmen and women, support economic development and encourage economic development. So the bill seems to have a flawed premise. The second would be that we believe strongly that the bill as written will discourage development and economic development in particular. Let me give you the reason why. We think the bill vastly increases the likelihood and scope of the appeals process by petitioners, because it allows petitioners to raise any issue, and any is a direct quote from the bill. It would directly and dramatically increase the workload of our already overloaded staff. There's a simple reason for this. Under the bill, the petitioner could file an appeal on just about any single decision that we made, and the responsibility to prove the case would not be on the petitioner. So I, as a petitioner, could file any sort of an appeal with very little backup and very little research. As the local government, my already overloaded staff would find itself, in my opinion, having to defend itself in every single case. So we'd have an increasing workload of petitions. And this, by its very nature, would delay action on other permits and other applications processes. Our view is that if you want quicker action and better certainty on the permit process, this bill takes us in the opposite direction. And finally, and this is a related to point number two, the bill, in our view, gives the people or the groups who oppose development or who oppose giving property owners the authority for additional conditional uses for their property a new tool to block action on development permits. Now, there may be valid concerns that led to this bill, as Don Schellenberg was just pointing out, and we would be happy to sit down and discuss those with him. But as written, this bill seems to go in the opposite direction from encouraging more efficient use of our permit process. We think there's ample opportunity for participation in the local process already, and this radical change to state policy will not help the system. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Riggs? Thank you, Doug. Well, it's obvious that this bill needs a lot of work, but that's the final person to testify that signed up. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2610 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2611. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Berry, thank you for controlling yourself this morning.
Have decaf.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2611 requires counties to identify proposed significant non-agricultural land uses and resources in exclusive farm use zones that conflict with agricultural resources within the same zone. It requires counties to develop a mitigation plan that preserves and protects existing agricultural uses prior to the proposed resource addition. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Administrator. Rich Engstrom.
While I'm standing, may I borrow the statute book just briefly, because I'm going to just read a section of it as far as this bill and then give it right back to the committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, one of our legislators is using that statute.
No, I can give this up if this is the one you want.
Just wait a moment. Please go first.
Go ahead.
I'll get it.
You'll get shot.
Nice.
Thank you for allowing me to come before the committee and testify on this bill. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. This bill has been up before the legislature for a couple of sessions now. At least I clearly remember last session, and might be one session before. We have considered this an anti-aggregate measure, and frankly, though, talking with Representative Cruz on this matter, I think that he's more interested in the relating clause on this bill than necessarily the substance of it. The reason I wanted the statute book for just a second is there's a measure already in the statute that deals with this that I thought I should just alert the committee to so that they have something to compare with. But as way of background, right now, a lot of uses, including aggregate, are permitted uses on EFU lands. And under 215, 213, and 215, 283, we are basically a permitted use on EFU land. There is then a section for all permitted uses in dealing with conflicts with agriculture. And that is 215, 296. And when I hand this back, I'll read it and I'll just hand it back to you guys so you can look at this particular measure. But basically it says a use allowed under ORS 215, 213, and 215, 283 may be approved only where the local governing body or its designee finds that the use will not, one, force a significant change in accepted farm or forest practices on surrounding lands devoted to farm or forest use, or two, significantly increase the cost of accepted farm or forest practices on surrounding lands devoted to farm or forest use. That statute basically sets up now the analysis that folks in the aggregate industry have to go through to permit a site on EFU land. Essentially, if we have conflicts with agriculture that significantly increase their practices or their costs, that's grounds for denying the application for mining. The bill changes, this particular bill changes that process in two ways. The first way is as far as process. Currently, issues that are raised at the local government level are brought before then the applicant to address them. They don't have to go out, under this bill, go out and conduct an analysis of those conflicts and then create a plan. This would significantly increase the cost of permitting aggregate sites statewide. And this is a huge concern to the industry because currently the to site aggregate sites statewide is ranging from $1 million to $5 million to get through the land use process. Frankly, from the industry side, the cost of siting aggregate has gotten out of hand. The second change that is important to us is that it changes the standard by which the aggregate industry changes the standard by which the aggregate industry has to deal with agricultural conflicts. Currently, if there is a significant increase in cost to cost to agriculture or a significant increase in agricultural practices, we have to then minimize those conflicts. This would change the standard from significance to any conflict and require us then to mitigate instead of minimize the conflict. And I'm not sure that it is possible on any conflict with farm use you can mitigate all of those, essentially make surrounding farmers whole, and that would be a very difficult standard to meet versus a minimization standard. The industry has opposed this particular bill in the past, and we oppose it here. We think that the present statute, though difficult for us to deal with, is sufficient. I should tell you that there is a recent LUBA opinion that just came out on the Eugene Sand and Gravel case. And in applying this particular statute that's in current in a current effect, 215-296, the LUBA held that any increase in ambient dust level from an aggregate operation significantly impacts agricultural practices and cost, and especially when you're dealing with things, anything with fruit. And the present LUBA opinion that came out last Wednesday pretty well shuts down any aggregate operations from our perspective statewide on EFU land. The system has gotten out of balance. Applying that particular, the current particular standard, this standard would just make it worse. Thank you for your time.
Any questions, Mr. Angstrom? Thank you, Richard. Harlan Levy? Levy? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm here also to oppose House Bill 2611 for all of the reasons you just heard. We read this bill as being an attack on the aggregate industry within farm zones, making it nearly impossible for them to site new facilities for mining of rock. And you might wonder, what is our interest in this? Well, if we don't have that rock, we can't build roads. We can't use it for other building materials. It does put a significant impact on what my people do if aggregate people are unable to do what they do. So when I first read this bill, I was concerned that it might have an impact on the ability of an individual to set a non-farm dwelling on farmland. However, I discussed the matter with legislative counsel, and we agreed that the bill is not aimed in that direction, but I did want to put it on the record that if this bill is aimed at making it more difficult to site non-farm dwellings on EFU lands, we would oppose it for that reason as well. With that, I will conclude my testimony and be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Art Schleck. Good morning again.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we too would add our voice in opposition to this bill, House Bill 2611. We do that from a couple of different standpoints. We manage, counties have the responsibility to manage agricultural land based on the statutes. The legislature sets forth the uses that are permitted within agricultural zones. Local government has no, and I repeat, really no latitude to add uses other than what the legislature has provided through the statutes. And so the non-agricultural resources have been identified as at least being appropriate, either as outright or as conditional uses within the agricultural zone. You have heard by the previous speaker, Mr. Angstrom, references to ORS 215-296, and I was going to take you through that, and since he has, I will not at this point. But just to repeat and to say that 215-296 sets out the standards by which you look at whether there's conflicts with a non-resource use and agricultural activities. That standard is not clear and objective by any way. It is subjective and allows for some interpretation as to whether there's a significant impact or not. But that is the those are the standards that the legislature has sought forth to have available to local government to make those evaluations. Non-agricultural resources can take place in a couple different in two different ways. One, through Goal 5 resources, aggregate is one of those that you can identify those activities in a planning process, in a legislative planning process, and do those. And then the other one is quasi-judicial, which 215-296 applies. Both of those.
The Goal 5 is the natural resource objective?
Yes. Goal 5 is natural resources, wetlands, aggregate, and a number of other kinds of activities. So those are the two ways that non-agricultural or non-resource activities can take place in an agricultural zone. This bill sets up, we believe, an additional burden to counties, and we believe that burden is an unfunded mandate at this point, with these provisions. Based on those comments, Mr. Chair, we would request that the committee reject House Bill 2611.
Any questions? Representative?
I'm just confused how this works, and maybe with your background and county planning at the county level, you can help me. But it says that when the county proposes to add a significant non-agricultural resource, what triggers that? I mean, does a county have to do this, or is this issue raised when an applicant wants to conduct a permitted or conditional use in exclusive farm use property? I'm just trying to see what triggers the county to act here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, as I indicated, it can happen in two different ways, and I'm not sure exactly whether this bill is intended to do both or just one. Goal 5, and let me use the aggregate since it's been discussed as an example. When you look at aggregate, and in Goal 5, if you have, and I can't remember the numbers at this point, but if a sufficient quantity and quality of aggregate, and it is sizable, you can go through the Goal 5 resource process to locate that in your planning process, that there is sufficient quantity and quality of aggregate that it should be protected. And in some instances, aggregate mining operations are identified in that process. Other ones of a smaller quantity, but probably a good quality of aggregate, are done through the conditional use permit process on a case-by-case basis and not through the planning process per se.
Can I just follow up? I guess what I'm confused is that where it says that the county proposes to add a significant agricultural resource. Suppose it doesn't. Is this bill triggered by any other action, such as filing of an application to mine and gravel an exclusive farm use property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, a conditional use permit would be triggered by an applicant by an applicant at this point. In the legislative process,
an applicant may come forth with the information and ask the county to initiate the process. Okay. And so the county would initiate the legislative process, maybe at the request, after getting information from an applicant, or, you know, an interested party at this point, but in the legislative process, the county would be the applicant.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We shall close the public hearing on House Bill 2611 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2431, which is a continuance. And we'll start off with Dwayne Smith. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Smith. I live in Benton County, born and raised in Linn County. I was in the real estate business for 35 years. I am now, in the last 5 years, been a wetland mitigation banker. So I see both sides of the picture here. How I read the bill, the intent is to ease regulations to be able to develop on wetlands, and to make the applicants have an easier time getting through the process. And I can support that. However, this bill doesn't do a very good job of that. Number one, changing the ratios of wetland mitigation would absolutely gut the permit system as we know it today. The permitting system is difficult, and anything we can do to ease it is good. This bill, in some ways, is better, in some ways it's worse. As it's written, unless it's amended, the wetland banking people are opposed to most of what's here. I'd like to just talk. I cited two banks. We have two mitigation banks in the state, one of which is in Marion County. And how that comes about, how I cited those, was to look at how much wetlands were available to be in cities in Marion County. And just in the city of Salem alone, there were 1,200 acres of wetland. So that looked like if there were going to be development on these lands, they wouldn't need to be mitigated for. The second thing I looked at is what is the cost of land that would be mitigated for. If there was a piece of land that's a commercial property that had wetlands on it, what's that land worth? What's the residential land worth? What's multiple dwelling land worth? Then you can see what the value that you're mitigating for. Then you look at the cost of mitigating, and then you decide whether the risk is worth it, and the risk is huge. Anytime you have high risk, you have hopefully high returns, but we don't have any idea what our return's going to be because we're required to monitor and care for this land 10 years after the last credit is sold. It costs us, our particular company, about $20,000 a year for each bank for monitoring and weed control, invasives. So if we have to do this for 15 years, we're talking about $300,000. But we don't know how many years it's going to be, and we don't know what the cost is going to be 10 years from now. We have no idea what our profits are going to be. Ask me again in 20 years, and I'll tell you. Right now, I don't know. There's been banks in the Marion County area for about 4 years. As close as I can tell right now, there's been 2.6 credits sold, and that's out of three banks. Our bank has been permitted for 2 years, we have not sold one credit. We have a very large investment there. And why that's happening is because of the way the rules are written. Not law, rules. It says first that you must avoid. So what that means realistically is they build around a wetland. And I don't know if you've seen what a wetland looks like after you pave around it. It dies. There's no longer a wetland there. I don't know if you've seen what a wetland looks like at the edge of a subdivision where they've moved it and the kids use it for a playground and a place for Christmas trees and leaves to be dumped. This is the result of the rules that we're facing. And so instead of being able to take that mitigation and put it in a wetland mitigation bank, which is already proven, already highly regulated, inspected at least annually, we're not able to sell credits. You look at the city of Salem with 1,200 acres of wetlands, and there's been 2.6 acres mitigated for in 4 years. Salem's being developed very rapidly. So that mitigation is going either in the in lieu fund, which, as I understand it, is about $1.5 million. And there's no oversight of that money. We don't know where that money's going, and no one seems to know where it's going. And we know that it's not being used for mitigation in the areas for which the money's being funded. So I'll just quit there because I know you've heard a lot of testimony on this. If you have any questions, I would be delighted to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Smith?
I have one.
You're Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Smith, you said that basically you would support this bill if it was amended, but not support it if it's not amended.
Yes.
Would you spell out specifically what amendments you would like to see?
The first one is, it says, without any permit action, for someone writing a check for $20,000 would be able to mitigate for 1 acre of wetland in the state of Oregon. The cost runs in the vicinity of $30,000 to $40,000 an acre if you went out to replace that.
So
we're losing
money.
Would
you like to amend this bill so that it does not set a specific cost or raise the cost?
Or at least raise the cost, at least so that it actually does mitigate. What we proposed was that there are rules right now that the state is using, and those are appropriate, that range anywhere from $18,000 to $77,000 per credit, plus the cost of the land. That makes sense. The second thing that I would change is that it may not require land for compensatory land mitigation any amount greater than a 1-to-1 acreage ratio. If you preserve the wetland, according to this paragraph, you have done the same thing as if you created a new wetland. And that's not the same. If you've preserved 1 acre of wetland over here and you've destroyed an acre of wetland, we already have this wetland. So we're losing 1 acre of wetland under this regulation. You can go in and take a wetland that is not perfect and make it better for the same 1-to-1 ratio. That doesn't work. That's gutting our permitting laws.
Does that not assume that all wetlands are of equal value and equal function?
No. This doesn't even apply to that. This doesn't even acknowledge that they have the same function. It's just saying 1-to-1 doesn't make any difference what it is.
Okay.
Any further questions from Mr. Smith? Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Committee, we have three more people signed to speak on this bill. Mark Knapp.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Knapp. I'm a grass seed farmer in Riccreol, Oregon, and I also own and manage a wetland mitigation bank. And I'm here to kind of give my input based on what the current bill offers and what it potentially could offer. As it currently is written, it really precludes mitigation banks from being a viable entity has been previously stated, but there's, I believe, there's been some amendments presented and hopefully will be added that would allow mitigation banks to serve as one of the primary tools to mitigate for the reasons that have been stated by the other mitigation bank owners. I think it's important to note that mitigation bank credits, when they are purchased, you're buying something that already exists. It's a known entity, and that's a huge plus. Myself as a banker, I think it's maybe been stated, but I don't know if it's been clearly stated, I don't have credits released until I have a product that's performing. And in our bank, which was established almost 3 years ago, we've had a third of our credits, 30% of our credits have been released. The other ones will be released as the performance comes. So when credits are purchased, it's a guaranteed product. You don't have the risk that's been involved in current mitigations. And that allows a process when someone comes in and buys that credit. It's the beauty of speeding up that process because they know they have a result. They know exactly what their costs are, and they can lock those costs in. The biggest cost that I incur, the biggest cost of my ability to produce credits is the time factor. As been stated, the inability of us to access the market has greatly increased the cost of our product. Because if I can sell my credits within a five-year period, I can sell them at a, let's put it this way, my cost is much lower than if it takes 25 or 30 years to sell those credits. And so I think this bill has the potential to improve the status of banks, which ultimately makes the cost of producing mitigation credits lower, which is, you know, ultimately is a benefit to the whole market out there. I think what's important is the market factors are what are going to drive this bill, and just to lock in a number which was in the original form of this bill doesn't take into account any of these other factors. And I think if mitigation banks are allowed to function as a primary tool, it's going to provide a great option for development, in addition to the fact that we're going to have much higher quality mitigations taking place in areas that have much more secure buffers and are going to provide the wetland benefits that the public desires. I have some written testimony I'll submit as well, which kind of covers some of the things. I didn't want to kind of reiterate that, but I know there's other time factors here. So that pretty much, you know, I think the bill as it was currently written has some major problems, but with amendments, I think it can be beneficial from all sides of the spectrum, both high quality wetlands as well as expediting the permitting process. Thank you.
Any questions? How did you get into the mitigation bank business, may I ask?
Read an article in the paper about I believe it was the first bank that was authorized in this area. I've been farming for almost 30 years. I farmed some very wet ground. It's been very difficult to farm. We've had some major goose issues and whatnot. I've done some wetland restoration using a federal program. I have a degree in wildlife science, so it's something I was interested in. It was highly successful, and I thought this is another avenue for me on my farm to be able to potentially diversify from strictly grass seed production, better utilize some really wet, you know, soils that were very difficult to farm, especially competing with some of the, you know, the high wildlife use we were having on it. And so I pursued the process, you know, got information, hired some consultants to give me some, you know, get me through the hoops, which are numerous. It took roughly a year just to get all the paperwork put together to get accepted in the program. And then we commenced the work in the fall of 2002, and we've been working on it since.
Representative, wildlife use, were they swans or geese?
Geese.
Okay, thank you.
But there's a solution, Cliff.
Thank you, Mr.
Oh, we have a few swans too, but you know they've moved in since, but not too many. It's mainly geese.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Chris Brown. Is Chris still here
from
Bayham? I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before you. My name is Chris Baham. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm giving some comments on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors. I'm just going to focus on one set of comments that OASIS, which stands for the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors, just focus on one particular comment. The rest are captured in testimony that I just handed to the assistant. OASIS is supportive of the provision, the general concept of the provision that requires DSL to encourage the development of mitigation banks. However, OASIS has some problems with some of the terminology used in that provision. For example, the focus on large centralized mitigation banks and the use of the term functional values. That term isn't consistent with current wetland science, and the focus on large centralized mitigation banks doesn't make sense ecologically. The reason OASIS supports the encouragement or the development of mitigation banks is it has difficulty in mitigating small mitigation sites. They have a high failure rate, as people have indicated in previous testimony, and they feel that road maintenance staff are not as qualified to maintain these sites over a long period of time, and that perhaps a mitigation bank could do a better job at ensuring the success of a mitigation site. And for that reason, OASIS would like to see more mitigation banks as an option to mitigating a small impact site. And that's about all I wanted to say at this time.
Any questions, Mr. Baird?
I do have one, sir.
Representative Green.
Your written testimony talks about page 2, lines 4 through 7, and some of the same issues on page 1, line 7 through something. Do you read this bill as written to essentially allow people not to use the permit process at all?
Aspects of it, yes. Paying into a bank as an option as opposed to going through the permit process kind of bypasses the permit process and the various reviews and other issues that are dealt with in that permit process, such as historic preservation, wildlife issues, things like that.
If I may follow, sir.
Follow.
But it sounds like you could support a bill that said you go through the permit process, you deal with all these issues, and one of the pieces of the outcome of the permit process is to buy a credit or do something else. So you would support the model that has people working through the permit process for all these DSL issues you talk about?
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Baham, you mentioned that functional values are not a part of current mitigation science. Would you explain what you meant by that?
So the term is consistent with mitigation science, at least as, and let me back up and say I'm not a wetland scientist. My background's in applied ecology, but from what I've read and keeping track of various issues in the development of the recent effort by DSL to revise its removal fill rules, wetland science uses the term as someone indicated in previous testimony, wetland function and wetland values, and they're two separate terms. One, wetland values, is somewhat a subjective term. It's a value we place on the work that wetland is doing. Wetland function is the actual work it is doing, for example, burnishing salmon habitat, or it's filtering water to improve water quality. Functional values kind of blends the two terms and to me creates a kind of a little confusion, and usually confusion leads to problems in trying to implement a law administratively.
Okay, so there's a difference between functional attributes as far as your definition is concerned and functional value.
Again, I'm unfamiliar with that term, although a wetland scientist might be more familiar with that. I'm just saying that I thought that functional values was a little bit confusing. It's inconsistent with what I've read to date.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And we'll ask John Lilly and Janet Moreland from Division of State Lands, and they will. Pardon? Sorry, your name isn't on the list. Would you like to add it? No, please.
Good morning,
John.
Good morning.
Hi, John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Lilly. I'm the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. While you were gracious and allowed me to testify on the first day of this hearing on this bill, I thought it would be worthwhile for me to come back and present to you in very brief form amendments that we have provided to the bill sponsors and to the chair and the committee administrator. I know you're not in work session, and so I'll just run through these quickly, and I'd be glad to answer any questions either about these amendments or about any testimony you've heard so far. The amendments are the last 4 pages or so of my memo to Representative Krupp. I referred to the various sections of the bill. I'm not going to go through all of these, but just highlight a few that I believe are most important. We've had some discussions with the committee administrator about the relating clause in this particular bill. They've assured us that though we believe it might be too narrow, the Legislative Council has reviewed and is comfortable with it, so I only offer that as just an item of note. We suggest that Section 2 be deleted in that we believe it would be confusing to the regulated public, and as well as make it difficult, it would actually make the state of Oregon ineligible to continue with this permit streamlining process to assume Section 404 of the Clean Water Act from the federal government. A particular note is the way that I read the bill, it seems to say that actually obtaining a permit might be avoided simply by paying into one of these accounts, either under what we call the payment to provide provisions or by obtaining credits from a bank. Given the particular section of the law that this amends, I would just say it's confusing as to what it's what the intent of the bill is intended to do. We are aware that there is some interest by folks who have presented to you about creating some fixed amount of money for payment to provide. We hear the same testimony you've heard from bankers that they would like some assurance about the amount of money that payment to provide about how much would be a proper payment for payment to provide, but their concern is, of course, that amount, if it's set in statute, is not undercutting to the credits that they sell, to the amount of money that they would charge for their credits, and we think that is a concern. We also note that there is some interest amongst some of the testifiers in trying to develop a smoother or more efficient, quicker permitting process for small impact projects. And the acreage that's being thrown around is a half acre of wetland fill. We're willing to discuss that from the agency's perspective. There may be some gains that we can make in terms of efficiencies. I think that what would be most important is that there be some understanding of how do we judge the functional attributes of those small sites. It turns out that about 50 to 60% of the total number of projects that we review are in that half acre or less category. Now, currently under our rules, for projects 2/10 of an acre or less, we do have a streamlined process to deal with those. I was interested in the previous speaker's comments concerning Section 3 about the dealing with centralized mitigation banks and the direction to DSL to create or advocate for such banks. We would advise that that language be deleted and other language be substituted, which would track more closely with more commonly acceptable terminology. And interestingly, we borrowed from our current regulations that came about as a part of a three-year effort working with consultants and counties and others to offer these reworded amendments for you. On the second page, I hear from folks concerns about the payment to provide, where the monies are going, and we did provide some information to Representative Krupp as to how much money is in the payment to provide account and how much has been spent. Interestingly, I think the most difficult thing we find with moving monies from the payment to provide account out on the ground is really not the number of projects, but rather our expenditure limitation. What happens is that we often can get many projects in the queue, but their total cost exceed the amount of money that the expenditure limitation we have in the budget, so we have to return to the e-board to get a limitation increase to be able to expend dollars. Sometimes good projects go by the wayside because people are ready to work and we can't provide them the money in their timeline. We don't have a proposal in these amendments to deal with that issue, but if the committee were interested, then we would be glad to work on amendments on that matter. Moving down on lines and under Section 8, we would suggest that you make it clear that your goal is that the state Division of State Lands definitions or methodologies for determining wetlands are compatible with that of the Corps of Engineers and the Natural Resource Conservation Service of the Department of Agriculture. In rewording lines 24 through 28 of that section, we'd suggest that the policy of the state in regards to wetlands be that we maintain a stable resource base of wetlands through the removal fill permitting process by considering functions, geographic areas, and wetland types, and the promotion of voluntary restoration, creation, and enhancement. This wording, we think, captures the original intent of what the bill sponsor was asking for and offers the flexibility to the state. Also, it tracks with the Oregon Progress Board's benchmarks for wetlands. And let me move right along on page 3. We've got some procedural suggestions. Current law says that the division would have 40 days to do a completeness review of the application. We've been doing this since July 1st of this last year when the law took effect instructing us to operate in that manner. The bill would require us to make those completeness determinations in 14 days. We believe there would be a fiscal impact if we were to cut the timeline down to that point. On the other hand, we do think that a reduction in the timeline from 40 to 30 days is consistent with what we're finding to be in practice. As it turns out, at least our first 6 or 7 months of operation, we're able to conduct the completeness review in much less than 40 days and more in the neighborhood of 30. And then another procedural streamlining fix that we'd like to see is the possibility that the director could shorten the public review process, particularly in the event that an applicant came in and showed evidence of having already worked with the adjacent property owners and commenting agencies. We think that rather running people through the review process twice just for the formality of it doesn't make sense, that in the era of an attempt to run permitting programs efficiently, that if the applicant has done the front-end work and contacted folks, lined them out, and we have in their application documentation of that coordination, then we should be allowed to reduce the amount of time that the public review process takes place. I think that's all I have for right now. I would mention a couple things after hearing some testimony. I think really the public policy question that's before you, insofar as banks are concerned, bankers make a personal investment in the entrepreneurial endeavor of mitigation banking. They'd like to know there's a market, and they'd like to know that there are folks who are going to be there to buy the credits when they develop them. Part of what I was hearing from folks testifying is that a market would be there more quickly if we removed the barrier to applicants to demonstrate avoidance and minimization, which is one of the first steps under state law and under federal law of mitigation. So the public policy question is, do we want to favor banks by removing this matter of avoidance and minimization for permit applicants, or do we want to just allow a permit applicant to go directly to compensatory mitigation through banking or payment to provide? I would suggest that if the state of Oregon were to do that as a matter of public policy, it might find applicants in a tough position with the Corps of Engineers in getting their 404 permit for similarly. In addition, the current federal law and federal requirements and the current state law tracks in much the same way, is that the applicant is required to show some effort to mitigate their project either on-site, meaning more or less within their property, or off-site, which would be nearby. Now, the current state regulations, those that we recently just adopted, have relaxed that principle of off-site and on-site to the point where we don't refer to those terms anymore in our regulations. But we still have the sense that folks are to look within a one-mile area of their project first to find mitigation before, and then farther before they go to what we call indirect mitigation, which would be payment to provide or compensatory wetland mitigation through bank. That is in its, we're still in the first 60 to 90 days of implementing that. We'd like some more time to work on that. But again, to return to the basic question, it is whether or not, as a matter of state law, we want to allow people to jump right to payment into a mitigation bank before they look at their project and try to avoid and minimize their impact first. I think that's all I have. I appreciate the opportunity to present today.
Any questions of Mr. Lewis, Representative?
Mr. Chair, what did you do different to speed it up from 40 days to 30 days?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, actually, there was no prior requirement for completeness in the old version of the law. One of the things that was done, it was done in Senate Bill 529 of the last session, was it laid out here that the division needed to lay out clearly what was required to be in an application. So that's what we put in the rule. Now when our folks look at the application, we look to see that all the boxes are filled in, all the paperwork is there, and we don't send people on a get me a rock exercise. There are times when we do, even now, reject an application because a signature is missing or a mitigation plan hasn't been included. But basically, we've put our own folks in a box and said, okay, this is the set of things that you're to look at in the application. And by the same token, we put applicants in a box and said, these are the kinds of things that need to be on the application. So that's what's enabled us to really turn those things around more quickly than we did in the prior years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, sir. I may be misreading what you're suggesting, but it looks like your changes, suggested changes in Section 12 and Section 13, and deleting lines 4 through 6 of Section 12 and 42 through 44 of Section 13, look to me like they're deletions of existing language, not deletions in the amendments.
Is that correct?
They're the definitions of the date in which an application is complete.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I was confused in reading this bill because It appeared to me that the definition for the date that the application is complete should have been in bold in this version, because I believe that that section is in bold in earlier versions. The reason that this bill is written in the way it is because much of this language is chapter law that would go into effect if and when the state were to assume Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. But my reading of lines 4 through 6 of page 14 of the bill are that those that term that that section should be bold.
And the same with the next one. We can check that, I expect, with the council. But it wouldn't be your intention to delete them if they are in the current act, is it?
Yes, it would be, Representative Greenlick, because, thank you for the follow-up, because, and let me point out why, if I may. This says that the date the application is complete is the date on which the applicant submits all the information required to make the application complete, or the date in which the applicant refuses to submit any further information regarding the permit. It's that last portion that we would object to. In this case, it appears that if the applicant doesn't says they're not going to give us any more information and we deem it complete. Well, that's a little different than the way it currently works. It's complete when the agency says it's complete because it meets all the requirements that are laid out in the rule.
So, if I may follow this one. So, your suggestion really would be to delete the last clause rather than delete the whole definition.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, that's correct. I prefer the language as it currently exists in the law.
Representative Richards.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lilly, we've now had several days of, or several hours of testimony, and so it's taking a while to kind of start to figure out what's really going on here because some of us don't have background in this area. So I'm now interested in your definition. Would you tell me what is meant by minimum replacement or minimum of acreage replacement rules?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm not familiar with that terminology.
I think it's related. It's called area for area, but I don't. I want to know what the status is of DSL on that term, and whether or not and what the status is of area for area as compared to, you know, functional attribute, and that comparison. What I really want to know is whether or not DSL is in harmony with Senate Bill 830 and the requirement for functional attributes to be considered. I'm concerned about the idea of wetlands that may be only 2 weeks out of a year versus being held possibly in the same position or status as a waterfowl reserve. And so to get there, I want to find out first what DSL's position is on area for area and what is being done to implement the idea of considering function and not merely ground size.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I think I understand where you want to go. The easiest thing for me to do is simply refer to the way the current regulations deal with that matter. When a person proposes to do work in a wetland, one of the requirements is that they provide a functional assessment of the condition of the existing wetland. And that means that the rule denotes and explains what the number of functional attributes are that might be looked at. Water quality, flood attenuation, the fish and wildlife habitat, the plant communities, the hydrologic conditions are among those. After the applicant has demonstrated that they've done everything in their project to avoid and minimize impact to the wetland, then they make the justification for mitigation. Mitigation comes in two forms, either what we call direct mitigation, which would be the applicant themselves going to on their site or nearby and creating, restoring, or enhancing an existing wetland. The second form would be indirect mitigation, which you've heard a lot of these last few days. Indirect mitigation is payment into the wetland mitigation bank under what we call the payment to provide provisions. That would be that a value is established, and the applicant pays that amount of money into the bank. Then the division goes and attempts to find someone to do work that would restore, create, or enhance a well.
We're beginning to repeat ourselves over and over here. Do you have any other questions, Representative Richardson?
If I may, Mr. Chair, I'll get to the point. I'm sorry to ramble. Quickly spoken, we have to look at two things, and you heard of testimony these last few days. One is you look to replace the functional attributes. Some of those attributes are connected to area, and flood being one, storage of floodwaters being one. So there are ratios in the rules which require, if you determine to do enhancement, then there's a 3-to-1 ratio because you're needing to create more functional attributes or better functional attributes in a wetland that's being enhanced. So there is a connection between attributes and area, and it's also borne out as the mitigation site is technique is either creation, restoration, or enhancement.
Thank you. And our last speaker on the subject will be Liz Frankel.
My apologies, I now realize what happened. I signed up at the last hearing thinking that there would be a carryover. My apologies.
Oh.
I'm not going to read my testimony. I am Liz Frankel, representing the League of Women Voters. We have a long history in concern for clean water. We've been involved in the rules. We've been involved in pretty much the entire process. I'll turn in my testimony. I will say, as a closure here, we do not have a financial interest. We do not have anything except a good public policy interest in this matter. We do not support this bill. Thank you.
Oh, there's the kind of witness we ought to have other people.
Thank you, Ms. Frank. We shall close the public hearing on House Bill 2431 and open a work session on House Bill 2431. Committee, we have received only one amendment to this bill. And all we have at this point is a draft of that amendment. So until the final, we were hoping a final draft would be available to us this morning to discuss in work session. But since that draft is not available to us at this point, we're going to carry this over until Tuesday and try to put it right at the top of our Tuesday agenda, the first item, to address Mr. Stewart's amendment to this bill, and have Mr. Stewart will expect you to be here to testify on Tuesday as to your amendment in a work session. Okay,
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
will we have available the amendments discussed in the DSL memo to Representative Kopler?
I have no amendments. This committee has not received any amendments from any other group than Mr. Stewart, and that will be the only amendment that we will discuss at that time on Tuesday. Okay, we will close the work session on House Bill 2431.
Point of information, you say we're considering Mr. Stewart's amendments. Are these self-drafted? Are these coming through a legislative council? I'm just confused as to what we're doing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they're coming through legislative council. Council Brendan McCarthy is drafting them. What you have before you is a working draft that he provided to me as the administrator for informational purposes. They are the only official having gone through the process amendments that this committee has received.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Any other questions of the committee at this point? We shall adjourn the House Committee on Environment and Land Use at 10:22.
This is still yours.
Oh, okay. Your okay. Miss.